starting on the bottom of Chafei Mudbet by the last line. Sandal ditznan gabi bechorot. The din of sandal that we find in the Mishnah in Bechorot, numai hilchotah. Why do we need that halacha at all? The Gemara's assumption over here is that a sandal always comes with another leida. That Rashi described to us, the Gemara described to us, that it's always twins, and that one of the twins smushed, crushed, and caused the problem for the other twin that is now a sandal. So the question is, if that's true, that means that whenever there's a sandal born, there's also another entity that's born. That other entity would then be the birth, and then whatever comes after it, why would it matter whether it was the sandal or the other entity that's born? It would have the same impact on whatever's afterwards. So then by Bechorot, why is the Mishnah there telling us that if you have a sandal, that whatever's born afterwards is not going to be a Bechor Lekohen? Forget about because of the sandal, it's because of the entity that's born with it. The twin that's born with it will take away the Kedushat Bechor from anything that comes afterwards. So why do you need to mention the sandal at all? So my answer is the Vo'acharav, that yes, it's not about another entity. It is actually about the twins themselves. If the sandal exits first out of these two entities, then the twin that's born afterwards is not going to be a Bechor the Kohen. The sandal that came out first would be the Peter Rechem, and then only the one that comes afterwards will be the Bechor the Nachala, because he survives, assuming that that's the case, and therefore he would be the Bechor the Nachala. And so the Mishnah is not speaking about a third entity that's coming out, but rather between the two entities, between the sandal and the other twin, if the sandal exits first, then that has impact on the one that comes after it, because he will be then a Bechor the Nachala, Veinu Bechor the Kohen, but he will not be a Bechor the Kohen. Rashi and Tosafot here argue about a fundamental piece of the Gemara here, which makes it that according to Rashi, the Havamina of the Gemara is more difficult, but the Maskana of the Gemara is easier, whereas for Tosafot it's the reverse. The Havamina of the Gemara is easier to understand, but the Maskana is harder to understand. Bali Tosafot quoted Yushalmi that says that when a twin is born with a sandal, it is usually not a viable entity. And so the child that is also born alongside of the sandal will also not be considered a viable entity. If that's the reasoning, or that's what's driving the Gemara's question over here. The Gemara doesn't think that we're speaking about the entity that's born alongside of the sandal, because whatever's born alongside of the sandal is also not going to be viable. It's not going to be an entity. And that's why the Gemara has the question as to what's the relevance of a sandal that's born. Whatever other entity is born with it will have the same impact. And so why do you have to worry about the sandal at all? And then the Gemara's answer is, oh, the Vo'acharav. Now for Rashi, that makes a lot more sense. The Vo'acharav is because the one that's coming afterwards means the twin of the sandal is a viable entity. And because it's a viable entity, then it explains why we need the sandal to tell us about this other entity. The Bali Yat Tosafot is much harder to understand than what the conclusion of the Gemara is. And also later on, the Gemara seems to say that it is alive, the other entity in the Bavli. Whether that means that the Bavli argues on that Yerushalmi that the Bali Yat Tosafot are quoting, or whether it means that it is alive until a certain point, meaning that this second entity that comes with the sandal doesn't necessarily viable in the long run, but it might have either short-term viability in terms of through the birthing or even past that point, and maybe that would help out the explanation of the Bali Yat Tosafot over here. So now, the Gemara asks the same thing with regards to sandal that's not gabei kretot, l'mai hilchata. The sandal that's mentioned in the Mishnah in Kretot, Mishnah in Kretot is dealing with the korbanot leidav and isha. And over there, why is sandal mentioned? Once again, if you have a sandal that is born, there will be another entity that's born along with it. That other entity will be mechayev, the woman in a korban leida. So why worry about the fact that the sandal is mechayevet, the woman in a korban leida? She's going to be chayevet korban leida for the other twin that comes out. So then, irrespective of whether there's a sandal there or not, she's chayevet in korban leida. And you can't bring a single korban leida on multiple births. So then, why does it make a difference about the sandal? So the Gemara answers, Shim teled vlad derech dofen, the sandal derech rechem. It's a case where she has a cesarean section for the entity that's going to make it, or for the larger entity, according to the Bali Tosafot. And the sandal goes through the rechem, goes through the birth canal. So there, you have a difference between them, because the Chachamim believe that only son that's born through what's called the Beit HaZriah, the area by which the woman is impregnated, if the fetus exits through that canal, then it's considered to be a birth for Korban Leida. So over here we have a cesarean section, you take out the baby Derech Dofen, that baby's not Mechayev the woman in a Korban Leida. The sandal that exits Derech HaRechem goes out the normal birth canal, that will be Mechayev her in a Korban. So that's the reason to mention this sandal. It's a very difficult case to understand in general, just because if a woman is having a cesarean section, it's unlikely that the second, whatever it is going to exit through the birth canal once the woman's already open. Maybe over here you could argue, because it's a sandal, it's a much smaller entity, that it can exit through the normal process, but that is somewhat difficult in general. So the Gemara says that that's the nafkamina by the Mishnah and Kretot, the mighty korban sandal. She brings the korban for the sandal because the other baby exited by a cesarean section and does not make chayev the woman in korban leida. Oh, the Rabbi Shimon damar, don't say derech dofen blad ma'al yehu. Rabbi Shimon disagrees and says that if you have a cesarean section, then that child that is born is mechayev the woman in a korban leida. He doesn't believe it has to go through the birth canal. Ma'ika the Meimar. Then there's no nafkamina here. Because even the regular Vlad is also going to be mechayever in a Korban Leida. Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, Shimteled Vlad, Biota Ovedet Kochavim. If she gives birth to the Vlad while she's still not Jewish. Visandal, Lachar Shin Nidgaira. And then she has a sandal after she converts. The Maita Korban Asandal. That she brings a Korban for the sandal. So, there is difficulty in setting up this case, exactly, but there has to be some delay between the time that the Vlad is born and then the sandal comes out. Whatever causes that delay, which we're going to discuss in a minute, gives the woman the opportunity to change from being an Oberet Kochavim to being an Isha Israelit. And then the first child that was born non-Jewish, because she was not yet Jewish, and therefore it's not Mechayev her in a Korban Leida. On the other hand, the sandal which exits after she's already converted, that sandal will be mechayev her a korban leida, and that's why the Mishnah brings the sandal, because you could have a situation in which both are born, but only the sandal is mechayev her in a korban leida. This is according to Rabbi Shimon, where the cesarean section is also chayev in a korban leida, and that's why he can't give the first answer that we gave before. Now, obviously, there are difficulties with this, besides what the Gemara is about to ask in 1 second. Difficulties of timing, or how exactly is this happening, because the process of conversion involves Kabbalat Olam Mitzvot, and then afterwards going to the mikveh. So if you go to the mikveh after you already have Kabbalat Olam Mitzvot, that means that sometime between the birth of the first and the birth of the sandal, she entered into the mikveh, and even based on the answers of the Gemara, there's not that much time between the two of them, so how do you exactly set up the case? The Ritva suggests over here that she's standing in the river. She's in the river going to do the tevila, and she gives birth to the first blood. She goes into the mikveh, or she's in the river, and then she gives birth to the sandal immediately afterwards. So it has to be in process. That's also somewhat difficult. It doesn't seem so realistic in terms of the situation, but then other achronim start to raise issues, like what about the fact that maybe there's a chatzitza in the tevila now, because you have a baby that's being born in the process of her going to the mikveh. So then does that baby or whatever's coming out become a chatzitza and a bayit achitzon? There are a lot of technical questions. So some suggest that you can reverse the process of geirut, which again is not simple at all that you can do this. But they say maybe if you could reverse the process, which is why she went to the mikveh, but she didn't do Kabbalat Olam Mitzvot. That would be a much more plausible scenario where she does the Kabbalat Olam Mitzvot in between the two births, because that's something that's short, quick, and easy. So maybe that's the scenario. So that all presumes that you can do it that way. And even if you can do it that way, it also presumes that that becomes the moment of conversion. There are some who say that you can reverse the process, but it works retroactively, which is that when you have the Kabbalat Olam Mitzvot afterwards, retroactively the mitzvah becomes the conversion, and not that it's prospective from the time of the Kabbalat Olam Mitzvot. But then you should just understand in terms of the difficulty of the scenario. But nevertheless, the Gemara is trying to come up for Rabbi Shimon as to why there'd be a nafkamina that there's a sandal born. Amru Rabbanan kamei de Rav Papa. Rabbanan said over all this that we've been discussing in front of Rav Papa. And then they say, Umi itnuhu lahane shinuye. Does any of this really work? Va'atanya, kishen yotzin, it yotzin elekruchin. That whenever they come out enwrapped in each other. So this goes back to the understanding here that this sandal was caused by the fact that there were twins, and one of the twins crushed or smushed the other twin, and that's why you have a entity that's coming out plus a sandal. And so the brighter that we're bringing now indicates that the way that they exit the womb of the woman is by being kuchin, enwrapped together, and that they are, Rashi writes over here, lo dvuki mamash. Right? It's not exactly that they're stuck together, but they are somewhat intertwined or connected, which makes it very difficult to understand now how do you have one in front of the other. Both of the cases of the Mishnayot seem to indicate that one came out before the other. How do you have such a scenario if they are kruchin? So Amra Papa Shmamina. From this you would have to conclude, Mikra Karchle Vlad Lisandal, that they are somewhat enwrapped or connected together. But again, as Rashi said, not exactly stuck together. So that Mikra Karchle Vlad Lisandal Apalgei, so the fetus is halfway up the sandal, and it slid, or it is pushed out towards its head. The crushing of the fetus had to happen at some point. The other Rishonim point out that that means that prior to this, they were either closer together, or the crushing happened whereby the force of the fetus is going to pressure the other fetus and that causes it to turn into a sandal. But at some point, they slip apart slightly, at which they point the head of the viable entity, according to Rashi, but in Tosafot, that's going to be a stillborn. So that head is halfway up the sandal. It's in what's called tiburo, as Rashi says. It's in the belly of the sandal. So the head's there, and the head's pressuring the sandal to exit. It's pushing it out, the sandal. But it's only up to a halfway point of the sandal. And so now we'll explain the two scenarios in the following manner. Gabi Bechorot, by the case of Bechorot, Kagon Shiatsu Derech Roshehem, that they were going out head first. The sandal Kadim, Benofik, so then the sandal exits first because of the way that they are structured now. The fetus, his head, is sitting at the halfway point of the sandal. If they're coming out head first, the head of the fetus is pushing the sandal out, and the sandal will exit first because it's slightly higher up than the fetus itself. So as they go out head first, the sandal will exit before the fetus does, and that's the scenario in Bechorot, whereby the sandal exits before the fetus or the entity that's going to come out afterwards. Vice versa, when it comes to the case of Gabi Kvetot, Shatsu Derech Maglutehem, they came out in the breach. The Vlad Kadim Benafik, in that case, the Vlad's going to come out first, because again, if they're situated in such a way that the head of the Vlad is only halfway up to the sandal, then if they're going out feet first, the fetus is sitting lower down, and then his feet will exit, his body will exit first, and then only the sandal will come out afterwards. We come out, those are the two scenarios then, by which they're stuck together, they're connected somewhat, but they're not totally enwrapped in each other, and that allows for a difference in timing between the exit of the sandal and the fetus itself. It does complicate the case of the mikveh, because now it's very hard to separate between them in terms of timing-wise. How do you get your very little time now between the exit of the sandal and the exit of the fetus? And you run yourself into bigger problems of the chatzitzot, because in this case, the sandal never fully exits before the fetus already starts to exit. And therefore, the woman is converting in between. It's a very difficult scenario, but leaving that aside, that's how Rav Papa explains this braita to reconcile with our explanations of the Mishnah in Bechorot and the Mishnah in Kretot. So then, Rav Tahuna bar Tachlifa, Mishmei de Rav Amar, he offers a different explanation for how we solve this problem of them being enwrapped with each other. Afilu teima mitzumtzamim. Even if they are literally enwrapped in each other, they're physically enwrapped in each other, no difference in the head, the legs, they're basically the same length. Ve'ipuch shmaitata. But then flip the way that you explained it. Kaveh Bechorot, Shiatsu Darech Margalotehem. By Bechorot is a case where they came out in the breach. They came out feet first. Vlad de'it be'chiyuta, the vlad that has life force in it, sarich velo nafik. He holds on. He fights the birth, and therefore he takes longer to exit. Sandal, the late be'chiyuta, the sandal which is not a live entity, then sarich v'nafik. It slides out quickly. Even though they're enwrapped together, the ability to exit the woman is different because the vlad will fight it along the way because it's alive, whereas the sandal, which has no life force in it, is just going to slide straight out. There's nothing holding it back. There's nothing forcing it back. That also could be just from size. Size-wise, the fetus is going to be bigger than the sandal, so it's going to take longer to get out versus the sandal, which could exit much faster. The only thing here is it sounds like from this that the fetus that's exiting is alive, which is more like what Rashi said before, that the entity along with the sandal is alive, whereas Tosafot brings that Yushami, that it's eight lit be'chiyuta, that it doesn't have life. But the Tosafot Rosh indicates that despite that fact that Yushami says that fetus born with the sandal is not a viable entity, but rather comes out also as a stillborn, Haino Shemait Bishat Yitziyato, he dies at the time of birth. Mitoch Hadchak Shedochachim Zedzeh, from the pressure between the two of them trying to exit. Aval imatziyahu chai. But while it's exiting, it's still alive. And that's what causes the slowing down of the exit, is because it's fighting the exit. But once it's already exited, once it leaves the birth canal, it dies because of all that pressure in the birthing process itself. It's alive when it's in utero. It only dies afterwards, or in the process of the birth does it die. And that's why this is maybe true, and the Bavli doesn't have to be arguing on the Yushami. Now, the other problem is that, in the beginning of the sugya, we said that the sandal affects before the Kohen, not before the Nakhla. Because the entity that's born after the sandal is considered to be a before the Nakhla, not before the Kohen. But if it is born and dies, then how is it possible that it's a before the Nakhla as well? The Marsha asked that question on this view of the Bavli Tosafot. And the Maharam explains to the Tosafot that even in the Maskana, the Bechor the Nachla here is a third entity, and the Havamina was that the entity that's born with the Sandal was a viable entity, and it was just a happenstance or an unusual circumstance that it died. And therefore, it should be classified as the Bechor the Nachla. The Sandal is the Bechor the Kohen, the other fetus that was the viable entity as the Bechor the Nachla, and then the one born afterwards would get nothing. The Gemash Mane is that whenever a fetus is born alongside of a sandal, it is not a viable entity and will die as well. And therefore, it's not classified as a Bechor L'Nachala, and only the one that comes afterwards is classified as a Bechor L'Nachala. That's the way Tosafot will have to read that beginning of the Gemara, unlike the way that Rashi did. Gabi Kretot, Shiatsu Derech Roshem. By the case of Kretot, it went out head first. Vlad de'it be'chiyuta, the vlad that is a live entity, midenofik reshe ha'vi'eleda. Then, once its head exits, that is considered a birth. Sandal adenafi grube. A sandal which is not a live entity, the birth is only classified as a birth when it exits rove. The majority of it exits. For something to be a birth, you need one of two things. You need rosho, you need the head to exit, or you need the rove of the body to exit. So, if it goes out, derech margalotav, it goes out feet first, then you have to wait for rove of the body to exit before it's considered a birth. If it goes out head first, then all you need is the head to exit for it to be a birth, a rove of the head to be exit for it to be a birth. So here, the Gemara differentiates between a live entity, a fetus. There, the head coming out is considered a birth. So as soon as the head exits, a rove of the head exits, you have a birth. The sandal, which is not a viable entity at all, there is no birth until the rove exits. So that would be a delay between the exit of the fetus and the sandal. And that's why the sandal coming out afterwards, it's delayed, it's behind the baby that is exiting, because the baby's head creates a leida, whereas for the sandal, you need the rove. A Tosafot points out that even though Shmuel says that a rosh doesn't help by nifelim, itotav, his position is rejected by the Gemara, which means that a nefel, that means a miscarriage, a stillborn, also the head is considered a birth. So why over here are we saying that by the sandal, that's not considered a birth? So Tosafot says there is a big difference. Nefel itle tzurat panim. A nefel has facial features to it. The sandal does not have tzurat panim. That's what we discussed in yesterday's daf. Also, we discussed the fact that a sandal, the face is crushed. and actually protrudes out the other side maybe and is ruined in that sense. So a nafel that has throughout the panim, then you could still declare the rosh as being a leida. But the sandal where the rosh or the face really doesn't exist anymore, in that situation, you can't say the rosh is deemed a leida. Now he's saying, well, if that's the case, why is it saying there has to be a vlad that's alive? It did not figure she lav davka. Deep bechiyuta doesn't really have to be alive. Da'afilo late bechiyuta. Even if it's not alive, but it's a nafel and it's a fully formed entity, then it is considered to be a birth when the head comes out. So all Tosafot says is that as long as it could have been a viable entity where it has throughout the panim and it's a nafel coming out now, that's enough to classify it as a leida with the rosh. If it is an unformed entity, it's a sandal, then you need rov to exit before it's considered to be a leida. Tosafot does bring the Rabbeinu Hananel's girsa, and he says that his girsa was vlad de'ipe chiyuta, a vlad that has life in it, medidafik rube, that once the rov goes out, it's considered a leida. Sandal de'ipe chiyuta, medidafik kule, the whole thing has to exit. And you have to say the rov here means rov arosh. And then kule is kol arosh. So that then it would be, the difference between them would be that a fetus or a live fetus, the rov of the head exits is enough. Whereas by a sandal or by a nafel, you need the entire head to leave. But you don't need the entire body to leave because nobody thinks you need the entire body to exit before it's born because everybody agrees rubo kukulo. So then the rach creates that distinction in the head. So that way also could be explained according to what we consider that a nafel's head that is born is also considered to be a leida. The difference might be that if it's a live entity, rubo kukulo with the rosh. When it's not a live entity, when it's a nafel or a sandal, then you need kulo rosho. That's another way to reconcile it. Although it does again run into bigger problems over here, whereby the Gemara seems to indicate that there's some sort of gap or spacing between them. Between Rov HaRosh and the Kula Rosh, there seems to be almost no time. And between them, it'd be very hard to make such a distinction. All right, so next Mishnah, which is a Mishnah that we quoted back on Daf Yud Chet. Sholya B'bayit. If you have a placenta in the house, Habayit Tamei. You can assume that the Bayit is Tamei, because along with the placenta, clearly some birth happened. And that birth is a non-viable entity. So now you have a human that has passed away in your house. If that's the case, then that's tumat hamet, tumat ohel. So the bayit is tameh. Lo sheshilya vlad. Not because the placenta is a birth, el she'ein shilya below vlad, but because the placenta always comes with a birth. The two are inseparable. You only have a placenta if there was an entity that was attached to the placenta that was born. So if you have the placenta, then you definitely have a vlad. You may not be able to identify the vlad. You may not even be able to see the vlad, but there was a vlad for sure if you have a shilya that's being discharged by the woman. Back on Yechad Amad Aleph, Rashi says that because rov shilyot that come out with a vlad. So Rashi just says it's a rov. Tosafot says that it's absolute. There is no such thing as a placenta without a vlad. Tosafot takes it as an absolute statement, which is ain't shilya below vlad. Rashi just takes it as a rov. The majority of situations where you have a shilya, you also have a vlad, and therefore we're going to deem there to be a vlad in a case where there is a shilya. Rabbi Shimon Omer, Nimoka vlad, Achlo Yatsa. Rabbi Shimon says, you're right, there's no shilya without a vlad, but the reason you didn't see the vlad is because it dissolved. It was crushed, flattened, dissolved, and then it mixed with all the other discharge of the birth, and it's batel berov. All that other blood and all the other things that exit the woman at the time of the birth, they overwhelm what was once the vlad, and the vlad is no longer existent because it's batel berov. So he agrees that there is a vlad that exited here, but the vlad is so destroyed or dissolved at this point that it's not meaningful in the context of all the other discharge of the woman. So Tan Rabbanan, Shilya Tchilata Domeh L'chut Shel Erev. The beginning or the start of it looks like a string of the woof. V'sofa Domeh K'turmus. And its end looks like that of a lupine. V'chalulak B'chachatzotzeret. And it is hollow like a tubing or like a trumpet. It's hollow on the inside. So here they're describing the placenta. Rashi over here explains that what does it mean in the beginning and in the end? It means kashi olechet viravachat. It starts out the placenta as being like a string-like feature, and then it expands to be the size of a lupine. That's one possibility. And the other possibility is that lishna achrina garsina betosefta rosha doma ketumus. That its head is like a tumus, and then clearly that would be explaining the two sides of the placenta, meaning that it expands. It's narrow, and then it expands to a wider side of it. What they're describing is that the placenta, which is connected to the fetus through the umbilical cord, so then the beginning of it by the umbilical cord is much narrower, and then it widens as it gets to the other end of the placenta. Ein shelya pchuta mitefach. And a shelya can never be less than a tefach, and that's the minimum shiur of what you consider to be a shilya. Rabbi Shimon Gamliel Omer, shilya domeh l'kurkuban. The shilya is similar to the crop, shiltana golim, that are found in the chickens. Shadakim yotzim mimena, from which the intestines exit. The crop is along the digestive tract of the chicken. So the side that is towards the intestines, the shape of the crop, is similar in nature to the placenta. So it's just trying to give a description so that you can recognize what the placenta is when you do see it, because they were much more familiar with the crop of the chicken. They might have been then with the placenta. Rambam writes, the crop is indication of thickness rather than a indication of size. Tanya, Rabbi Oshaya Zeira, the younger Rabbi Oshaya, the Min Chabraya from this location, Chabraya, or you can say that Min Chabraya means from amongst the Tamidei Chachamim, Kamisha Shuran Tefach. There are five halachic areas where there's a requirement for a tefach. Beilohin. These are the five. Shilya, Shofar, Shidra, Dofen Sukkah, Vaizov. Those are the five, and now they'll explain each one of them. Shilya, Hadamran. Shilya is our situation here, that the minimum for a shilya, for a placenta, is a tefach. Shofar, Ditanyo. If a bright, Kamiyei Shiur Shofar. What is the minimum shiur for a shofar? Perish Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, Kadesh Yachzenu Biyado, Yirei Lekan Ulekan, Tefach. It's a case where if you're holding the shofar, you have enough to hold the shofar, plus there'd be a visible shofar on one end and the other end. Now, a tefach, according to the Gemara, is where you align your thumb four times. If you have four thumbs succession, that is a tefach. So now, if you hold the shofar, the way you hold the shofar is with the four fingers over the shofar. So four fingers are going to be narrower than four thumbs. And so then if you have a tefach with a shofar, your four fingers, when you grab it, will have a piece of the shofar sticking out at one end and then on the other end. First of all, that seems to make the din of shofar somewhat subjective, which is that then there's no objective tefach. What happens if an individual has a very large hand? And then even with the tefach, when he puts his hand on it, there's no sight of the shofar on either end. Is that a kosher shofar? Maybe it's kosher because objectively for most people, a medium-sized person, that has to have a tefach, but this individual not. So the halacha, we try to say that it is somewhat subjective, and therefore we'd prefer anybody who blows the shofar have enough that their hand has visible shofar on both ends, especially since the Rashba mentions that part of the reason for this is to make it clear that the person's not blowing into their fist, but blowing an actual shofar, so you need some visibility of the shofar on both sides. And so that's important that you have visibility even in a bigger person's hand. The other thing is that even if you have a shofar that is smaller than that, it would seem that this is not a shi'ur that is me'akev, and that one would be allowed to blow a shofar that is smaller than this, that this shi'ur tefach is midrabanan, and that it's not me'akev, the mitzvah of shofar. Although later on, from the Gemara's perspective, it seems to be that this is a Doraita requirement, a Torah-prescribed requirement. And if that's the case, then it would be ma'akev, the ability to blow the shofar. So that's shofar. Now with regards to shidra, spine, mahi, damar rav parnach, amar rav yochanan, shidro shel lulav, the spine of the lulav, tzarech she yotze min hadas tefach, has to extend above the hadasim, at least the tefach. So not just the leaves of the lulav, but the spine of the lulav has to extend above that. Rashi over here tries to describe what exactly is the shidra. Kari kozman shalim holchim umitchabrim umosifim. It's as long as the leaves are going up and attaching together and mosifim and add more leaves. That's considered to be the shidra. The shidra needs to sit at tefach above the hadasim. Tosafot over here discusses why the Gemara in Sukkah leaves out the word Shidra in the Memorot that we see in Sukkah. And he says maybe the Gemara here added in the word Shidra to what is being said in the Memra of Rabbi Barnacham and Rabbi Yochanan, that added in the word Shidra, and that wasn't part of their original Memra, but they did it because that is true. The halacha that the Shidra, the spine of the Lulav, has to extend above the Hadassim. Dofen Sukkah, the wall of a Sukkah, the Tanya, Shtaim Kiyochatan, the requirement for Sukkah is to have two full walls, Shlishit Afilu Tefach, and the third wall can even be a Tefach long, and that's learned out in the Gemara in Sukkah from the halacha of the Moshe Mitzrayim, that the third wall does not need to be a full wall. And then the Makok between the Rabbanan and Rabbi Shimon over there, as to whether it's the third wall or the fourth wall that does not need to be a complete wall. But either way, according to either one of them, that additional wall, which doesn't have to be complete, only has to be a tefach. So there's another case where we have tefach. Ezov, when it comes to the hyssop, the Tani Rabbi Chia, we have a bright of Rabbi Chia, Ezov tefach. Ezov has to be a tefach long. Now there are three places where we need Ezov. One is by the Tarata Mitzora, you need the Ezov. You also need it by the Parah Adumah in two places. You need the Ezov to sprinkle the water and ashes of the Parah Adumah onto the individual with Tameh. You also need the Ezov to burn along with the Parah Adumah. So it seems like the reference here is to all three of those instances, that the minimum size of an Ezov, the Issup, is a Tefach. So Amar Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa, Dorish Shila Ish Kfar Tamarta, Rabbi Chanina Bar Papa says that we have a, whether it's a mnemonic or a memory aid or an explanation by Shila from the village of Tamarta, of the date village, Plat Matnita Vitarte Shmaita Shiura Tefach, that there are three of these Tefachs come out of a Mishnah or a Braita, and two of them come out of Memrot of Amoraim. The problem is, Tarte, two of them from Amoraim, Chadei. We only have one Memra from Amoraim in the list that we had here, and that was the Amar Rav Parnach, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. That was only Memra from Amoraim. Everything else quoted here was a Braita or a Mishnah. So then, where do you have this that there's three and two? We only have four and one. So how does that work? So Amar Abaye, Ema, Amar Rabbi Chia. Change the Memra over here to read, not Tani Rabbi Chia, rather, Omar Rabbi Chia, Ezov Tefach, which is very interesting. Rashi over here makes a comment that Rabbi Chia, Tana, Ve'amorahu. Rabbi Chia had the standing of both the Tana and Amora. We have, like by Rav, that Rav is an Amora, and sometimes he's given the status of Tana Hu Upolig, that he has the right of a Tana. Rabbi Chia is the opposite way around. Rabbi Chia is a Tana, and sometimes he's also an Amora. Now, we know that Rabbi Chia is a Tana because most of the Braitot that we have came out of the school of Rabbi Chia. He's a Talmid Muvak of Rabbi, and he and Rabbi Shaya are the ones who put together the Braitot. The Braitot that come out of the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Chia have standing to them because they're considered to be vetted Braitot. And whenever you can ask questions from them, you can rely on the veracity of the Braitot that come out of the school of Rabbi Chia. What Rashi points out is, that's only true when it's Tani Rabbi Chia. When Rabbi Chia is quoting a Tanaic work, that's when it's considered to be a Tana or he's a Tana. But when it says Amar Rabbi Chia, that's a member of an Amora and he has the status of an Amora. So what the Gemara does here is switch it from Tani Rabbi Chia to Amar Rabbi Chia, which switches it from a Tanaic work into an Amoraic saying. And in that way, we get two and three. If two Amoraic things, and the rest of them are Tanaic statements. Betuleka. There are no more other things that require a tefach. Vaika, tefach al tefach al rom tefach miruba. When you have a cubed tefach, meviyata tumah v'chutzeitz b'pnei tumah. That is an ohel. That's the minimum shiur for an ohel is a tefach cube. And that has nafkamino that if there's tumah inside the ohel, it stops the tumah from breaking out. And anything on top of the ohel is now tahor. Had it been that it was less than a tefach, then it would be boreitz tamala and anything above it would be tameh. In addition, anything within the ohel is also classified as being tamei. Not only things that are touching the mate, but even things under the same roof as the ohel will also be tamei. So you see there, there's a minimum shiur of a tefach cubed. Why isn't that among the list here? So Gemara says, that's not going to be included in the list, because tefach kamrina, tefach al tefach lo kamrina. We're talking about a shiur, we're talking about a single dimension of tefach. We're not talking about a multi-dimensional object that requires tefachim. So that's why oil is not included in the list. Vaika, Evin Ayotze Min HaTonur. Also in Masechet Kelim, with regards to the stone or the handle that comes out of the tanur, can be a tefach long. Min HaKira, from the stove, Shalosh Etzbot. It can be 3 etzbot. Now Rashi over here translates tanur and kira in the following manner. He says the tanur has room for 2 pots to be put on top. A kira has the room for 1 pot to be put on top. As Tosafot points out on the Amud Bet, Rashi, Lefi, Harifato, quoted the Gemara in Shabbat, but he's misquoting the Gemara in Shabbat. Gemara in Shabbat distinguishes between 3 items, tanur, kiraim, and kopach. And there the Mara says that a tanur is an oven in which they baked bread. An oven has an opening on the side, and it has like a pyramidic shape to it to trap the heat inside. They used to bake the bread by putting the bread around the side or the walls of the oven, but it was entered through the side and it was an oven. That's a tanur. A kira is a stove, which is that the openings are on the top, and then you put the pots on the top of it. You heated it from underneath, and then you put the pots on top. There, the Gemara distinguishes between a kira and a kopach. It says a kira has a place for 2 pots on it. Kopach has only a place for 1 pot on it. Rashi brings that distinction and applies it to tanur and kira over here, which seems incorrect because that's not the general description of it. So Tosfot on the Amud Bet points that out, that in the Gemara and Shabbat, it doesn't sound like what Rashi is saying over here. Nevertheless, the idea being that a tanur is bigger than a kiraim, that's what we're after over here, and the handle that is on the side is considered to be attached to it for the matters of tumah. That is kli cheres, which we're speaking about here. These are earthenware utensils. Earthenware utensils are only mekabel tumah mitocho, internally. They don't accept tumah externally. Once they are tameh internally, they can convey tumah externally. So then the question is, what's considered to be the external part of the kli cheres or of the oven over here? So if you have a sheretz that's inside the oven, and that sheretz makes the oven tameh now internally, the external part of the oven will be tameh. What about those handles on the side of the oven? Those handles on the side of the oven are considered to be a part and parcel of the oven, like the back side of the oven. And therefore, if you have something or food sitting on that handle, it'll become tamei if there's a sheretz inside of the tanur. So the Mishnah in Kelim says, how long can the handle be and it's still considered a part of the oven? So by a tanur, it says up to a tefach is considered to be a part of the oven. Beyond a tefach, it's not considered part of the oven because you're going to cut it off. It's too long and you're going to cut it off. By a kira, which is a smaller entity, then it's 3 etzbot. That's how much is considered to be a part and parcel of it. Beyond that, it's considered to be too big. The reason being is that you want to put it up against the wall. You can't put it exactly against the wall because the heat of the oven will ruin the walls. So you have to have some gapping. That gapping is the size of a tefach. And so the handle at a tefach is considered to be a part of the oven. Beyond a tefach is too big, and it's going to cause problems with pushing the oven up against the wall, and therefore you're going to slice it off or cut off that handle because it's too big. So that's why up to a tefach is considered to be a handle for the tanur. So if that's the case, you have another shiur of tefach. Where it says, Kikar minan eched debatsimi tefach lochazi. Here, the tefach works in the opposite direction. In any other case, less than a tefach is pasul, tefach and greater is kasher, tefach and greater is meaningful. Here it's the opposite way around. Below a tefach is more likely to be classified as a tanur than above a tefach. So it works the opposite way. In the shofar, less than a tefach is a not kosher shofar. More than a tefach is clearly a kosher shofar. But the tanur is the opposite way around. The handle bigger than a tefach is not going to be considered part of the tanur. A handle less than a tefach will be considered part of the tanur. So it's the opposite way around. The tefach here is functioning in a different way as a threshold. It's the cutoff rather than the beginning. By the other cases, the tefach is the minimum shear. Here it is the maximum shear. And that's why it is not mentioned in the list. Vaika tenurei banot tefach. So what about the tenurei banot? Rashi says tenurei banot are ne'arot ktanot osim tanurim l'skok. These are clay ovens. The Fisher-Price ovens that the little girls played with. So they are the size of a tefach. That's the way Rashi reads it. Tanurei, banot, the tanurim of the young girls that are a tefach. Tosafot reads it as a phrase. They are tanurei, banot tefach. They are tanurim that are the size of a tefach. It's not about banot, about girls. It's banot tefach means they have a tanur the size of a tefach. That's the way he reads it. And we'll see that later on based on his explanation of the Gemara. The Tanya. Tanur, tchilato arba'a. A tanur, the minimum size to be classified as a tanur, is 4 tefachim. Vishiyarav. And if you had a bigger tanur and it broke and you still have a piece left that is dalit, 4 tefachim, that is considered to be shi'arav. Dalit is still considered to be a tanur, and it could be mekabel tuma, or if it was tamei, it still would be tamei. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Chamim omrim, b'med dvarim omrim, when is that true? Begadol, that's with a big tanur. Aval b'katan, when it's a small tanur, tchilato kolshu, in the beginning it's at least a kolshu, mishitigmar melachto, when it's finished, b'shi'arav, b'irubo. And the remainder, the residual, is b'irubo, b'ro. Now the Gemara asks, "V'kama kolshu? What is a kolshu? Amar Rabbi Yanai tefach. That is a tefach. Shukenu sim tanurei benot tefach. Or going to Rashi, tanurei banot tefach. So going to Tosfot, they make tanurim that are the size of a tefach. Or going to Rashi, the tanurim, the plate tanurim of the children of the girls are a tefach. As the Bali Tosfot point out, that shows you that when the Gemara uses the term, or the Mishnah uses the term kolshu." Sometimes it means more than a tefach, sometimes it means less than a tefach. Doesn't always mean literally a kolshu. Kolshu just means a small amount. That small amount has to be defined. It's not always literally a kolshu. The Gemara answer is Pelukto Lokomairi. The reason that's not included in the list is here because there's a machlok between Rabbi Meir and the Chachamim as to the rules over here, and we're not dealing with machlokot. Even though by Sukkah, there's also a machlok between the Chachamim and Rabbi Shimon as to which wall it is. Nevertheless, as the Bayit Tosfot will point out, that machloket is only about which wall it is. But the additional wall, which is either the third one for the Chachamim or the fourth one for Rabbi Shimon, is a tefach. They agree about that. So they don't argue about the tefach aspect. They just argue about which wall it's relevant to. And that's why it's not considered to be a machloket to be left out of the list of items here. Now, what is going on in this braita that we just quoted? Rabbi Meir's opinion seems to be very straightforward, which is you have a minimum shiur to be classified as a tanur. That's 4 tefachim. So 4 tefachim is the minimum shiur for the smallest tanur. Also, if you have a bigger tanur and it breaks, as long as you have 4 tefachim left, then you still have that size that's there. The Chachamim say that there's a distinction between beginning a tanur. Someone will only build a tanur that is a certain size, but then once it's already built, they'll still continue to use it even though it's diminished in size or it's broken in size. The example that the Tosfot HaRosh brings, but something similar to what we find by tzitzit. That by tzitzit, there's a certain minimum shiur for tzitzit. And then we have gardumav, that which is left over afterwards. The gardumim of tzitzit can be smaller than the initial tzitzit. That's why if your tzitzit rip, they're still kosher, the tzitzit. As long as there's gardumim are the size of a gudol, so it's the size of a thumb, then they are still considered to be kosher tzitzit, even though the minimum shiur for starting is much larger than that, much bigger than that. So similar concept here by the oven. Now Tosafot is bothered by the fact that if you can have a tanur that is a tefach, then why is it that the minimum shiur of a shiarav, a leftover tanur, is 4 tefachim? Because if you can make a tanur that's a tefach, then why is something that was bigger that comes out to 4 tefachim considered to be a tanur that's no longer viable once it goes below 4 tefachim, or no longer useful below 4 tefachim? You just told me you have a 1 tefach tanur is fine. So Tosafot over here says that this is speaking about the height of the tanur, and that we're speaking about how tall is the tanur, and it has to be relative to its width. If you start out with a very narrow tanur, then a bno tefach, one that's tefach high, is good enough to be shomer the heat and to work with in that situation. In the case where you have a very wide tanur, you need a much bigger height in order to make it a useful or workable tanur in that case. It seems almost counterintuitive because you would think the smaller the space, the easier it is to heat. So the wider the oven, the lower the roof, then the more it would heat. But Tosafot seems to indicate that in order to be maybe functional in terms of its heat, if you have a very wide tanur and very low, it's not going to give you the type of heat that you want to build up. Because remember, they plaster the things around the edges of it. So if it's too wide, the heat's not going to disperse properly. Therefore, you need a taller tanur for the heat to evenly distribute amongst the tanur. If you have a narrow tanur, then you can have a lower roof and still have it distribute evenly in the tanur. That's, first of all, Tosafot's explanation of the difference between gadol and katan as to why there's a threshold of 4 tefachim, yet there can be a tanur that's 1 tefach. He says they're not overlapping concepts. One's a tanur gadol, one's a tanur katan, and they're different entities completely. And that's why Tosafot, we said before, says that the tanure b'nol tepach. They're b'nol tepach because they're a certain type of tanur. It's narrow, so they can be a lower roof in the tanur. So Rashi brings the Gemara that describes this in Chulin. Makshev orotev, rova tepach, what can you use it for? Mushani haidi shiarav a gadol koi. That shiara that says rove is not on the rove of a tefach, the koshu, the small tanur, rather on a big tanur. V'achi gamar, shirei gadol birubo. A big tanur, the rove is considered to be the leftover. Umotvina, and then we ask, v'gadol, v'akamar shirav dal. You just told me by a big one, four is the residual. Umushanina, my answer is, by a tanur that is seven tefachim, four is considered to be the residual. And then, in the case where it is tet, where it is much bigger, then you need the rove. The way the Gemara answers is that the four tefachim is the leftovers for a seven tefach tanur. A tanur that's bigger than seven tefachim, then you need rove. So four is the rove of seven, and then any other tanur that's bigger, you still need the rove of the tanur. That's the way Rashi explains it over here. And that's the way the Tosfot explains it in the Gemara in Chulin. But Rashi in Chulin says just the opposite. Rashi in Chulin says that by Zayin you need Rubo, that by a Tanur that's seven you need the robe of the Tanur, and by a Tet you then have four Tvachim can still be a residual. And then no matter how big it is, four Tvachim is considered, always considered to be the residual. So by a Tanur of seven, you only need a little over 3.5 to be the robe. Any other Tanur that's bigger than that, four is considered to be a stand. So what Rashi is saying in the essence is that any big Tanur, in the end, the residual of its four tefachim is still a functional tanur. Doesn't matter how big it gets, but in the end, if you have four tefachim left over, it's considered to be functional. And that's the way Rashi explains it in Chulin. The advantage of Rashi's explanation in Chulin is then you can understand why the word number four came up. Because four is just a minimum objective shiur of four. Over here, the way that Rashi explains it here, and Tosafot explains it there, the problem is, why is four considered to be the robe of seven? The robe of seven is 3.5, just over 3.5. So you say, oh, it's the next whole number that makes it whole. Okay, fine. Then why did it go to 9 afterwards? Why doesn't it go to 8? Then why do you say, when it's 8, you need rove? Why did it go to 9 instead of 8 to become the rove afterwards? Well, because 8, the rove is really just over 4, so they wanted to use 9. So there are ways to explain it, but from Rashi's perspective, the explanation of it being the reverse makes it easy to understand. Four tefachim is an objective shiur. Rove is just over 3.5, and that's explained. Otherwise, here, you have to explain, when you explain it the other way, you have a problem, because you have to explain the shiurim over here as to what their relevance is. Although, Tosafot over here explains why he thinks the explanation of Rashi here and his explanation in Chulin make more sense, because of the way that the Gemara structures it, that it seems to be indicating that there is some ratio that exists between the beginning of a tanur and the residual of a tanur. If that's the case, then it would make more sense to say the 7 requires 4, and that the 9 requires rove, the way that we explained it here. Right, now the Gemara says, Hashidati d'ochi, now that you're telling me that we don't involve machlokot in the list here, then hanami pluktai. So that too is a plukta, the tanur and the kotel. We said over there we didn't include it because the tefach was a maximum shiur rather than a minimum shiur. That's why you didn't include it. But now that you tell me you don't involve machlokot, that's also machloket there in the Mishnah about the tanur. The Tani Seifa, because the end of that says, Amar Abiyuda, lo amru tefach elamina tanur lakotel. That the tefach is only a limit between the tanur and the wall, because there you want to get it as close to the wall as possible. And then on the other side, he says there's no limit. The Chachamim says it's a tefach on both sides. Abiyuda says the tefach is only relevant on the wall side, because there you don't want to have the oven so far away from the wall. But on the opposite side, you could have a long handle over there, a long thing to use on the other side. Why not? Because it goes into the house. There you have plenty of room, and there's no reason to cut it short. Chachamim say that in general, people want a limit to the size of their tanur, and that's on both sides. A tefach is considered to be the maximum. But now that it's a machloket, then we don't include it in the list, and that might be the reason we don't include it in the list. Mar says, Vayika miskeret tefach. What about the fact by the shulchan, in the Torah it writes that it has a miskeret tofach saviv. It has a crown around it that's the size of a tefach. Why is that mentioned? Midichtivan lokamairi. Things that are explicitly written in Torah, we don't include in the list. Vayika kaporet tefach. What about the cover of the aron, which was a tefach? And that's not written explicitly in the Torah. It just says a kaporet. We have a Mesora that the Kapara was a Tefach thick. Why isn't that written? Kodoshim lo kamari. We're not dealing with the world of Kodesh. Vayga dayala korah shirach va tefach. What about by a mavoi? At the end of a mavoi, you need to put up a sign that that's the end of the mavoi in order to do a shituf mevo'ot to carry inside the mavoi. Because the mavoi sits on the edge of the Rishut HaRabim. We don't want people carrying from the mavoi into the Rishut HaRabim. So we have to put a heker, something there to remind them. So either you put in a lechi, which is a standing pole, or a korah, which is a plank across the top. That korah has to be a minimum of a width of a tefach. So that's also something that requires a tefach. My answer is, we're not dealing in rabbinic requirements. By mavoi, it's completely rabbinic, which is that the institution of shituf mevot is all midrabanan. I mean, a Torah you can carry in there no matter what. It's not a problem. It's a reshut yachid. And the korah for the mavoi is an institution midrabanan. And the requirement of a tefach is also midrabanan. The whole thing is drabanan through and through. Ela b'tichtivan elo mifarshi shirayu. What we're dealing here is things that are written in the Torah, that the shiurim are not explicit in the Torah. So those are five items by which they're written in the Torah. They're doraita requirements, yet the shiur is not written doraita. That would imply that the shiur is doraita, it's just not written. Although you could read the Gemara as saying that even though the shiur is the Rabbanan, it's still something that is written in the Torah that doesn't give you a shiur, it needs a shiur. So the Rabbanan told you what the shiur is. That goes back to what we mentioned before as to whether the shiur of shofar is d'oraita or d'rabbanan. It would have enough kamina if you have a small shofar, whether you can blow it or not blow it, at least me d'oraita. Yativ Rav Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta, kamed Rav Kahana. Rav Yitzchak bar Shmuel bar Marta was sitting in front of Rav Kahana, yativ kamar, and he was saying the following. Amir Yehuda Marav, kol shlosha yamim arishonim, for the 3 days after the birth of a vlad, tolin et ashilya bavlad. Any placenta that is discharged afterwards is considered to be connected to the blood. And you should know that some people translate shilya over here as being the fetal sac. It doesn't seem to be that way. It seems to be that the shilya is the placenta. But either way, the discharge that comes out should be somewhat connected to the birth of the entity. Because the entity was either contained in the sac, or if the placenta was attached to the placenta, you would assume that the placenta exits in a timely fashion along with the birth of whatever is coming out because the two are correlated or connected. In under 3 days, we do not assume that the placenta is connected to another fetus or another birth that's taking place. We associate it with a birth that took place. On the other hand, if it is more than 3 days, then we worry about the placenta being connected to a different entity. And the first entity that was born with the placenta, but we missed the placenta, we lost the placenta. And the second entity, we're missing the vlad, but we have the placenta, but they're two different entities that were born here. Amalei umi amai Rav Hachi. So Rav Kahana says back to him, did Rav really say that? Vamarav, in a vlad mitakev, achar chaviro klum. That when you have multiple entities that are being born, they are born in succession. They don't wait. There's no gap between them. If the woman is birthing, she can't hold in whatever is in there. Whatever's in there is going to come out. And that's true today as well. Very hard. Many times they try to do this with multiples. They try to birth one of them, take them out, and then leave the others inside. And most times it doesn't work because once the woman starts to contract and starts to push out, it's very hard to stop the process. Now, medically, they can do it with drugs and other things, but then it makes it hard to get the first one out. It's a very difficult thing to do. And what Rav is saying is that if there's going to be a birth, whatever's in there is going to be discharged. At this point, it's going to be birthed at this point. If that's the case, then how can you have a scenario by which you have a birth now, and then the placenta that exits 4 or 5 days later, that's associated with a different blood, with a different birth that's happening. What do you mean? If there was a different birth, we would have seen it at the time of the first birth. There's no other birth here. How do you separate between the two? So Ishtik, Rav Yitzchak Bar Shmuel, was silent. Why he is silent is interesting. Tosfot says that mitzchila shachach, he forgot it. Uperis of kunches, uperis beat me, hatzarech lamar to mitzchila lo chashla shivo. He says, Tosfot says he forgot. And then he's reminded in a second about what Rav said. According to Rashi, which the way that Rashi explains it, Tosfot claims that Rashi thought that he knew the answer, he just didn't bother to answer him. He just was holding back and he didn't answer him. Then Amalei, so then Rav Kahana says to Rav Yitzchak, Bar Shmuel, Bar Marta, Dilma kan ben Eifel, kan ben Kayama. Depends on what's being birthed over here. Do you have a viable entity that's being born? Or do you have a nafel that is being born? And the two would be different. Amalei. Atamart shmaiti de Rav? The way Rashi says it. Wow. You were saying this in Rav's Shita? The way Tosfot says it is, Komar kavanta miatzmecha? You were able to think of this on your own? That's exactly what Rav said. So the way Rashi says it is, wow, you're saying what Rav said? And so that's why Tosfot says that Rav Yitzchak Shmuel knew what Rav said, he just didn't answer it. And then Rav Kahana says it, and he goes, wow, you knew what Rav said? Whereas Tosfot says it, that he forgot. And then when he said of his own, he's saying to him, Atamart l'shmaita de Rav. You are now saying exactly what Rav said, and you are mechaving to that. B'feiru shamar Rav Achi, that's exactly what Rav says. He pila nefel, v'achakach pila shilyach. If she gave birth to a discharge that was not a viable entity, then she afterwards discharges a placenta, kol shlosh yamim tolina to shilyach b'vlad. If it's within 3 days, we connect between the discharge, the miscarriage, and the shilyach. Mikam elech hoshishim l'vlad acher. At that point, then we assume that there was another vlad if it's more extensive the time in between them. Yaldav achakach pila shilyach. She has a full birth and then had discharges the placenta. Even there's a 10-day gap between them. In choshishim the vlad acher. We don't worry about a vlad acher. Basically, what Rav says is when you have a real birth, then everything comes out. And that might be for two reasons. One is that a real birth requires a large opening of the birth canal, and therefore that anything that's there is going to come out. Or because the need for the heavy contractions to get out of birth, that the live entity like that, is also going to push anything else that's out. So that might be the two reasons. And then by nafel, you're missing those two things. By nafel, first of all, it might be smaller, and therefore you don't have to open the birth canal as wide to let it out. Maybe there's something still in there, and that didn't come out at that time. As well as the fact that maybe you don't need as extreme contractions to push out the nafel. Again, it all depends on the size of the miscarriage here. And that's what most of the Mefarshim explain over here, that we're not talking about necessarily a live entity. It has to be an entity that could live, or could successfully live. Not that it actually has to live, and that's what Rashi says, Kiyotze bo mitkayem. Because that would explain that it's size-wise that it makes a difference. Because if it could have survived, then it's big enough that it would open up the birth canal wide and cause heavy contractions. So in that way, it would push everything out. Whereas if it's a nafel where it doesn't have, it wouldn't survive, because either it's not a viable entity or because of its size, in that way, it will not force the opening of the birth canal and won't force its heavy contraction. And even though, as Tosafot points out, the Gemara later on is going to speak about cases where there is a difference of 3 months between the birth of one vlad and the other vlad, says that's milta de lo shkiach. That's an uncommon occurrence. And therefore, if we have to be choshesh for something, more likely to tie the shilyach to the vlad that's born, 10 days later, then we are to say that it's a different birth that's happening. So you have to take probabilities. If I'm going to take probabilities, even after 10 days, I'm more likely to associate it with the original birth than to associate it with a totally separate birth that's being delayed to a later date. Shmuel v'tamidei de Rav, Shmuel and the Talmidim of Rav is obviously after Rav had passed away, because the Talmidim of Rav are there and Rav Yehuda. Rav Yehuda Shinano, who is Shmuel's Talmid Muvach, also learned by Rav first and then moved over to Shmuel after Rav passed away. So Shmuel has the Talmid of Rav and Rav Yehuda sitting, they were sitting together. Chalev Azel Rav Yosef braid Rav Nashia Midvil, the Apayu. So Rav Yosef, the son of Rav Nashia from the place of Dvil, is approaching them. Bali Vate, he's in a rush. He's moving very quickly towards them. Amar, Shmuel seems to say over here, Atlan Gavra, the Raminan Le Gila de Chitita. This is a person that I can ask him straw questions, Umirame Umidache. And he just gets stuck, and I can push him away with these questions of Kash. For whatever reason, they had some sort of negative association with this Rabbi Yosef Breda Mirab Nashia. And Shmuel is saying that or indicating that through the fact that he can ask him silly questions and bump him off and not have him bother him anymore, whether that means that he used to bother him a lot, and then he could push him away with these silly questions because he couldn't deal with them, or because there was some other altercation or difference between them. Adahachi ato. And after Shmuel says this, Rav Yosef Bremen of Asher shows up. I'm like, Shmuel, my amarav b'shulya. Let us know what you have in Mesorah from Rav with regards to Shilyah. They must have been learning the sugya of Shilyah. He says, then what did Rav say about this? Amalei Yochi Amarav. This is what Rav says. Ain't Tolina to Shulya, El Dover Shul Kayama. That we only connect a Shulya to something that is a viable entity. And as I pointed out to you before, Rashi says it doesn't mean it has to be a viable entity. It has to be the possibility that it would have been a viable entity. It itself does not need to be a viable entity, but it has to be something that could be a viable entity. Shailinu Shmuel the Chol Tamidei Rav. He looks around, he has all the Tamidim of Rav sitting there, and he looks at them and he says, did Rav say what Rav Yosef said? From Lei Hachi. And they said, yep, that's right. That's exactly what Rav said. Hader Chazil Rav Yehuda Bishut. Then he gave a dirty look at Rav Yehuda. Shmuel gives a dirty look to Rav Yehuda. Because Rav Yehuda is the Talmid of Rav, used to bring all the Memorot of Rav to Shmuel. And here he didn't tell him this Memra from Rav. And Shmuel was upset at him that he hadn't told him this Memra from Rav, which was important for him to know. Baimine Rav Yossi ben Shaul me Rabbi. Rav Yossi ben Shaul asked the following question of Rabbi. Hamapelet demut orev vishilya. A woman who has a miscarriage of a something that's the shape or form of a raven and a shilya, also a placenta. Mau, do we connect between those two items? Amalei in tolina davar sheish bimino shilya. You can only connect a placenta to something that normally has a placenta. Birds don't have placentas. Since birds don't have placentas, they don't have live birds. So therefore, you can't say that if she birds something that looks like a raven, that the placenta is connected to that birth, because normally a raven doesn't have a shilya. Shurabo, what happens if the placenta is actually attached to this discharge that comes out? Ma'o, what's the din? Amalei, davar she'eno shalta. You're asking about an impossible case. It's just not possible that that's the case. Maybe what you have to say in Rabbi's defense here is that we know that it's not having a raven, but something that's the shape of a raven is indicative of a quote-unquote non-viable entity or an early discharge. And so an early discharge, if you later on have a placenta that comes out, it's unlikely that the placenta should be connected to that discharge that looked like an orave, because an orave or whatever's coming out wouldn't have rendered a placenta of the size that we're seeing now, or the discharge of a placenta. It would have been something that's smaller, or something that would have been dissolved there. Maybe that's how you have to explain, Rabbi. So, Eitave, is that really true what Rabbi says, that there is no such thing as the case that Rabbi Yossi ben Shaul presented to him? Hamapelet min beima chayavoth. A woman who discharges, miscarries an entity that has the shape of animals or a bird. Vishilya imahem. And there's a placenta along with them. Vizmacha shilyak shura imahem. If the shilya is attached to them, ein choshishin levlad acher. Then we don't worry about there being another entity in there. We assume the placenta is connected to them. On the other hand, if the shilya is not attached to them, then we worry about another vlad being in there. Since these entities are coming out, or oddities that are coming out, we don't assume that the placenta is associated with them. We assume the placenta is associated with a different vlad. So then you would have to associate with them the chumrot of two births over here. Shani Omer, because now I say, Shemani Moach Shafir Shel Shilya. Maybe the Shafir, which is the fetal sac of the first Shilya, dissolved or was ruined somehow. Vinyamoach Shilya Shel Shafir. And the first discharge, which was the thing that was the shape of an animal or a bird, there the Shilya, the placenta of that one, also dissolved. But what you see from that is that the Braita clearly believes that there is a shilya that can be connected to an oaf. Because it mentions behema chayav oaf. And over there it speaks about the possibility of it being shura, number one. And number two is, even when they are not shura, we're chosheish that there was this oaf came out with a shilya that dissolved. So we're saying that it does have a shilya that is associated with it. Now the truth is that you could have answered that it's only referencing the behema and chaya, not to the oaf in the Braita, but that does not seem to be the pashtut of Braita, and therefore the Gemara leaves this as a tiyufta, as a strong refutation of Rabbi's position that an oaf doesn't have a shilya, and an oaf cannot be connected to a shilya. Both of those seem to be possible based on the Braita that we just brought. Now, in terms of what we do here, in terms of chumrot shel shneihem, depends on the machloket between the Chachamim and Rabbi Meir that we saw earlier in the perek, which is when a woman discharges something that's behema chayav oaf, is that considered to be a leida? So for Rabbi Meir, that's a leida. So if it's a leida, then she's already tmeya, either zachar or nekeva, if we can identify the gender. If it's a zachar, then we're chosheish for the nekeva with the shilya. And then we'll put the chumrot of a nekeva on her. You have to have 2 weeks of tumah. and he only gets 26 days of Tara, because we give the Chumrot to both Zachar and Nekeva. If it was a Nekeva originally, then the Nekeva will have impact in terms of starting the process of 2 weeks of Tumah and the 80 days then. And then when the Shliach comes out, there'll be another start of the days of Tumah, so the days of Tumah will extend longer, and at the tail end, she'll have a problem of identifying when the days of Tohar end, and the Nidah begins, and that'll have Nafkamina, both for Nidah, Zivah, and the Mei Tohar, as we discussed yesterday. For the Rabbonon, who believe that a discharge that looks like a Behema Chai Ve'of is not considered to be a Leida, then for them, what is the Chumrot of two Vladot over here? So the answer is that we give them the Chumrah of a Leidat Nikeva, which is means that the Chayav Oaf and all that is not considered to be a Vlad at all, and therefore she has no Dam Tohar at all. And then, when it comes to the second birth, which came out with the Shiliah, over there we're going to force her to keep 2 weeks of Tumah, and no Yemei Tohar. So that means the Chumrah of Shneihem. Chumrah of Shneihem is the first thing we don't consider to be a birth at all, and therefore you get no Yemei Tohar. The second one is considered to be a birth, but a birth that's safek, and therefore you get 2 weeks of Tumah, no Yemei Tohar. And that's what it means to get the Chumrot of the Shnei Vladot. Tosafot does point out in a number of these items that both on the bottom of the previous Amud as well as on the top of this Amud that involves a Sfek Sfeka. And then why don't we just say Sfek Sfeka Lekula? So Tosafot says that we don't invoke Sfek Sfeka Lekula because Iyav Sharbet Tepayu, the Meza Lekula, you can't call Lekula by both of them, the Sachu Adodi. Because then it'll end up being that they are mutually exclusive positions, and therefore, as lean into Tarvayu the Chumrah. And for that reason, we lean to the Chumrah by a lot of these cases, even though there's a possibility that it's really a Sfek-Sfeka, maybe we shouldn't entertain any Tumah whatsoever. So Tosafot here is Mechadish, that whenever you have a Sfek-Sfeka, that will also require us to then say an opposing Sfek-Sfeka to be the Kula on both of these issues, then that doesn't work. That Sfek-Sfeka is not a proper assumption in this halachic situation. And therefore, we're going to go the Chumrah by Tarvayu, whereas other poskim might say that we invoke the first Sfek Sfeka, and then when it comes to the second Sfek Sfeka, we don't allow you to invoke it, because that would undermine the first Sfek Sfeka. They at least allow the first Sfek Sfeka to get off the ground. Here, the Balei Tosafot won't even let the first Sfek Sfeka get off the ground, because there's a possibility later on that you might want to invoke a Sfek Sfeka that is in the opposite directions. For instance, if you say here that it's a Safek, whether there was a Vlad at all, and even if it was a Vlad, maybe it's a Zachar, so she only should keep 7 days of Tumah, not 14 days of Tumah. But then, if later on she has a sighting on the 34th day and the 41st day, then you're going to want to invoke Sfek Sfeka the Kula to say that she really had a Nekeva, because that will make both of those Riyot of Dam Tohar, and it would be to the Kula in that way. But the Kula of saying that she had a Zachar and only 7 days of Tumah here is in opposition or contradiction to saying that she had a Nekeva to make it the Kula later on. The Stira between those two Tzadim, the Kula, make it that we go the Chumrah by both of them. Or Tosafot later on says that when it comes to Sfek Sfeka by Tumat Yoledet, the Chachamim ignored Sfek Sfeka and made everything into one big Sfek, and therefore everything is the Chumrah or the Tumah rather than the Kula. Alright, we're going to stop here, three lines down on the top of Chavzayin Amud Aleph.